This is a podcast for Wednesday, February 15th, 2012. Theories of Knowledge.
So today we're going to finish up Kant and review for the exam. Exam will be the same format as last time. Multiple choice, true or false. It'll be based on Berkeley, Hume, and Kant. So the latter part of chapter 3, after law, and then Kant. There'll be a few questions which might involve comparisons with Descartes and Locke. So you'll have to know those philosophers in as much as they relate to the current philosophers, but there won't be any particular questions on just Descartes or just Locke.
Chapter 3, after Locke. Up to and
including Kant. So, and this is, you know, kind of heady stuff, the Berkeley, Hume, and Kant. So it's all, you know, basically empiricism and Kant. The first one was intro and rationalism. This is empiricism and Kant. And again, you'll have to know rationalism as it contrasts with empiricism. And how both relate to Kant. So if you saw a question, for example, true or false, Kant is a kind of extreme empiricist.
False.
Yeah, what if you got Kant is a rationalist?
False.
What if one of the selections were, what if there was a multiple choice question which said, Kant's view is best described as, you know, A, rationalist, B, empiricist, C, a synthesis between rationalism and empiricism, D, none of the above.
Which we say
C. Okay, yeah, it's chapter heading, right? Okay, so good job. So Kant, we talked about, I think, his views on cause and effect, and just to recap. If you're an empiricist, you have to restrict yourself to what you can sense. So when you're trying to think about the concept of cause and effect, is there such a thing? And you try to sense the necessary connection between cause and effect with your five senses, it ain't going to happen. So then you have a choice. You could say, oh, well, so much the worse for cause and effect. Or you could say, this empiricism thing, not working out so well. Maybe we need to change that. And that's essentially what Kant does. Kant says, look, you know there's a real world out there, a world of matter. You know that there is such a thing as cause and effect. Can't prove it with your senses, so you must know it through your reason. It's a rational presupposition. And it's a presupposition required to do science. And so Kant's epistemology says you need to start out with certain basic principles which you know through pure reason, through logic. Like there's a world out there which is the cause of your senses that it obeys regular laws of cause and effect, and that some things cause other things to happen, that the world is pretty much everywhere the same, the laws of cause and effect in this room are the same as the laws of cause and effect over in the center building and in the gym and you all, even on the moon, that you have the same causal laws, that they're universal, that the universe is pretty much everywhere the same as homogeneous. And so those are presuppositions that scientists make, and there might be a few exceptions, like you get into things like Big Bang cosmology and talking about the first few seconds of the universe, and then the laws of physics get really weird. But if you're talking about, you know, the world, the universe as it, you know, exists, you know, post, I don't know how many, let's say a billion years after the Big Bang, you know, pretty much the laws of physics are the same everywhere. And even a black hole, the laws of physics, you know, things act differently, but that's just a different application of the laws of physics. So you have to presuppose cause of the material world, cause and effect, the homogeneity of the world, that it's pretty much everywhere the same, and then the laws of logic and mathematics. And once you do that, then you can use your senses. then you can use a generally empirical method. So this is the opposite of like the rationalist might say, okay, well, let's think about do heavy objects fall faster than light objects? This is what got one of the things that got Galileo into trouble. Because you get somebody like, I think Aristotle makes some comment about, well, of course, heavy objects fall faster than light objects. And the medieval philosophers were the view, you know, oh, Aristotle said it, I believe it, that settles it. So it was Aristotle in the Bible, and they're just quoting authorities. And one of the things that set the Renaissance apart from the medieval period is people started doing experiments. Instead of just quoting authority, people said, oh, I want to find this out for myself. But somebody like Descartes might say, if you're a rationalist, you might say, okay, let's think about the concept of heaviness and think of the concept of falling, the concept of lightness and falling. You think, oh, well, if I think about a feather, that's something that falls very slowly. If I think about like a cannonball, that's something that like drops really fast. So I think about those concepts in my mind, and it seems like the lighter object would fall more slowly. Whereas what Galileo did is he took two objects, like a really heavy, you know, ball and a really small ball, and I think he actually made them the same size. So he like the really the light one, he sort of had a hollow in the middle, and then he dropped them, and I think he had like a little track that he rolled them on. And sure enough, so you get this like really heavy cannonball and then a ball that's made out of something like paper mache or something like that, right? That's really, really light, but it's the same size. Because the reason, do you even know why the feather drops more slowly?
Surface area.
Yeah, surface area, and so air drag, right? So it's got this, you know, it's got more air drag. You get more resistance from the air when you drop it. So if you're dealing with just gravity, you got to take air drag into account. The same reason why, like, if you take when a flying squirrel jumps off the branch, right? He just kind of sails down really slowly. Whereas if a regular squirrel falls out of a tree from two fall up, you know, he's going to fall very fast, right? Yeah. So. Although, you know, if you're smaller, the fall doesn't hurt as much. So it's one of the reasons why you can take, like, a beetle and drop it from this high, and they'll be fine. Whereas if you took a human being and dropped them by a proportional height, he wouldn't be so fine. But anyway, if you look at Galileo did this, and he did an experiment, again, using the senses, and saw, oh, look, the balls hit the bottom of the track at exactly the same time. If you take a really heavy object and a really light object, that they're exactly the same size and shape, and you drop them at the same time, and you hit the ground at the same time. But that's something you have to use your senses to do. Yeah?
Isn't that where they came up with the pound of feathers, weighing a pound is going to fall the same? It's just what is a bigger mass to get
right
that pound?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, so a pound, it doesn't matter. So it doesn't matter what the substance is. It doesn't even matter how much it weighs. It's all like based on the air drag.
Okay.
And heavy objects fall just as fast as light objects.
In a vacuum, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, in a vacuum, it doesn't matter, right? So you could do another experiment in a vacuum. Although, you know, the Middle Ages, that might have been a little difficult to do. So. So you can't do science a priori, and this is sort of the empiricists really hinged on this, and they said, look, if you want to find out about the world, you got to go out there and poke around and do a bunch of experiments. You can't just sit there in your philosopher's chair contemplating the eternal verities and thinking about how concepts are related to one another. And so so people said, yeah, empiricism is the way to go, and Descartes and the rationalists sort of fell out of favor. But then later on, Kant, who's sort of, you know, still thinking in terms of rationalism, and you have these German rationalists that were sort of into the sort of conceptual thinking and ignoring the senses. And so finally Kant read Hume, and he says, Hume awoke me from my dogmatic slumbers. And so he goes into the empiricist camp, but then he runs into all these crazy conclusions. And then combines the best of both. So his view is you need to start out with these basic assumptions, which you know through reason, and then you can use a generally empirical method. So he's combining the best of both. So you have some a priori assumptions, and then you use a posteriori investigations. And the most important category from that chart, the synthetic
a priori.
Synthetic, which means, you know, facts about the world. I'll say non-trivial facts about the world, which aren't definitions or descriptions of essences.
What is the word "non"? Trivial.
Synthetic a priori.
Non-trivial. Okay.
Non-trivial. So, going back to Hume, Hume says, if it's about concepts and definitions, math and logic, it's all reason, a priori. It's if it's facts about the world, if it's about what exists, it's about facts about what's going on in the world, then it's a posteriori, use your senses. And Kant says it's not that simple, that there's some facts about the world that you know through pure reason. So every event has a cause, it's not the definition of event, right? Because you could say that an event happened for no apparent reason. You could say an event happened randomly. To say every event has a cause is to make a substantial judgment about the world. To say that everything that happens for a cause, for a reason, which explains why it happened the way it did. So every event has a cause is every event has a cause. There is a material world responsible for my experiences, separate from my mind. The universe is homogeneous, which means it's pretty much the same every place. If you look at one part of the universe, another part of the universe, the same laws apply everywhere. If you take a bit of copper and it conducts electricity, if you go to Timbuktu and dig some copper out of the ground, it's the same stuff. It's going to conduct electricity. I suppose, you know, I have a mind.
Are you saying that's synthetic, that there is a material world responsible for my experiences? Like, what is that statement pertains to? Synthetic or what?
Yeah, it's synthetic because it's a fact about the world that the material world exists. So that there is a material world is a fact of existence. It's not the definition of something. So you can ask the question, does a material world exist, and it makes sense. So that assumes that there could be a material world, or like, you know, Descartes assumes in the first meditation, maybe there is no material world and it's all a dream. You know, Berkeley didn't believe in the material world, and he's not, when Berkeley says the material world doesn't exist, he's not making a contradiction. So you can sort of imagine there not being a material world. Kant says that it's something, so it's a fact about the world. It's not a trivial truth of logic like A equals A. It's not the definition of something. It's not describing the essence of something like, a triangle has three sides, a bachelor is an unmarried male. Those are just sort of trivial truths about concepts. It's like define the concept of a bachelor. It's an unmarried male. It's a priori. A triangle is a three-sided figure, a priori. That's something it's a conceptual truth you know through reason. But it's a truth like, this cup has coffee in it, right? That's a synthetic truth. It's not a statement about all cups. It's not about the definition of a cup or the essence of a cup. It's about what's in this particular cup. And so that's a synthetic truth. And in the same way, there is a material world. It's like this cup has coffee in it. It's a more general truth, but it's a truth about the particular facts of the world. That the world is material in nature and that it's separate from my mind. And so that's a truth which is, it's a fact about the world. It's not a definition, and it's not about like the rules of logic. But it's also, it's a priori. Your senses can't tell you there's a material world which is the cause of your senses. And Kant says Hume's right about that. That just shows you that knowledge doesn't all come from the senses. Some of it comes from reason. And it shows you that there's some synthetic truths which come through pure reason. So there's some facts we know about the world that we know through pure reason. And Kant calls these things presuppositions because they're things which would have to be true in order for you to have the kinds of experiences you have. So you think, okay, I like to interact with the world every day. Sometimes the world obeys my will, sometimes it doesn't. I notice there's regularity. I notice that I can describe the world through these mathematical equations. There has to be a real world out there independent of my mind for all those things to happen. Otherwise, I wouldn't have these sorts of experiences. And so Kant says that you have to start out with saying, I have a mind. My mind is aware of some external reality. And that external reality obeys laws of cause and effect. And that's your starting point. And then once you know that's true, then you can go out there and use your senses to investigate things best you can. And what can you know about the world apart from your senses, the real world? Again, Kant says you can never know the world in itself, but you can know some things about it. You can know that it exists. You can know that there is such things, cause and effect. And you can know that the world exists independent of your mind. And apart from that, you're going to have to be happy with the world as you experience it. But what you can do is you can study the world as it appears to you and make all sorts of generalizations about it, write a bunch of equations down, describe laws of gravitation and the laws of chemistry and physics, and you can make mathematical models to predict the future. And so what you have is like essentially a science of appearances. And you only have indirect knowledge, you know, of the noumenal world, the real world. So the noumenal world is the real world, the world in itself. You can never observe the noumena. You can never sense it. You can never directly experience the real world. You only experience the world through your senses and through what Kant calls the categories of human experience. And I just briefly talk about the categories. There's like a lot of different... I could go into depth in this, and in a more in-depth class we'd go into that. But essentially, Kant says it's not just your perceptions that lock you into experience the world a certain way. It's just the way you think about the world. Like, think about substance and quality, or quantity, time and space. And these are all categories in which we experience the world. And Kant says that the real world doesn't really contain these categories as we think about them. It contains, you know, something which causes us to experience the world in certain ways, and our brain sort of makes sense of all the data we get and creates the concept of an object, say, of enduring material objects. But really, if you think about the concept of substance and quality, like we break up this cup, we say, well, what is it? It's an object. What is it? What are we going to call it? The cup. What do we know about the cup? Well, then we start listing its qualities. Like it's made out of plastic and it's purple and it holds 16 ounces or whatever, and we can list all its dimensions and its shape and so on. And those are facts about the cup. And we think about the cup as a thing, and we think about its qualities, ways which describe how the thing exists. But in reality, there's no separateness between the substance and the qualities. It's all just, there's something out there. And the categories of substance and quality is something we impose in the world.
The same thing with quantity.
So how many, about how many objects would you say exist in this room?
A lot. More than two.
Okay, more than two.
More than I want to count.
Yeah. Yep.
If you were to give a ballpark figure, would you say like maybe 100, 1,000, 1,000,000? Yeah.
It really just depends on how precise you want to be. I mean, you might consider every atom an object, because then with that said, we could go infinite, because every particle of air could be considered a part of this quantity that we're looking at.
Yeah, and that's essentially Kant's point. Like this pen, is the pen, is that one object? Oh wait, no, there's the pen and then there's the cap, right? And so would it count as two objects? Well, if I take this pen apart, there's like the tip here, the little felt tip, that could be another part of it. If you look inside here, there's these little spokes inside, so does each of these little spokes count as a separate thing? There's a little cartridge in here that holds the pen, so if you break it apart, there's a whole bunch of different parts. Again, I have the cup, and I got, you know, the lid, and the coffee. It's going out here. And you can keep on going down, and you think about the chair, there's the plastic part, there's the metal part, there's the seat, there's the back. And you can go down to the molecules and the atoms, and so there is no real answer to how many objects are there in this room. It's a human convention that helps us sort of sort out the world, classify things, be able to predict things, be able to communicate meaningfully with one another. And it's a humanly created world. You can imagine like a race of aliens, instead of thinking about the world in terms of objects, they might think about it in terms of processes, right? So think about a river. Like a river, we tend to think about a river as an object, but really a river is just a process of water flowing through a certain predefined channel. If you think about a flame isn't really a thing, it's the process of combustion. So what if you thought about what we call objects, what if you thought about everything sort of being like the river and the flame? Like you can imagine the alien mind might think about the process of molecules sort of moving around and cohering together. Or you think about a biological organism, right? Matter's going in, matter's coming out, being converted to energy. So you could think about, there's all sorts of different ways you could conceive of the world. And the way we think about it might just be one way. And it's useful, and we have these models which describe the world in certain ways. But Kant says we should shouldn't confuse our descriptions of how the world appears to us with how reality is in itself. How is reality in itself? We can never know. So that's the noumena, is unknowable. So we just be happy to know about the phenomena, which is the world as human beings experience it. And that's, you know, Kant in a nutshell for all his sort of technical jargon and indecipherable prose. That's Kant's view. Another way of looking at Kant that we talked about last time is Kant sees everything like Locke's secondary qualities. So remember, secondary qualities are these qualities that are a kind of a combination of the way things really are and the way we experience it. So objects don't really have color, but there really are wavelengths of light that are bouncing off of objects and reflecting to our eyes. But we experience objects as red, for example, because we have color receptors in our eyes, which produce red sensations in us when they hit a certain wavelength of light. Kant says even the concept of a wavelength of light is a scientific model. It's not the way the world really is. And so it's just all a model. And it's all something created by the human mind. Now, it's the human mind as it interacts with the rest of the world. So it's not like it's not like Berkeley, where God sent us the ideas, or it's not like Hume, where we're just having ideas coming from some mysterious place, these sensations, we don't know where they come from. There is a real world out there causing our sensations. We just can't know what that world is apart from the way we experience it. another way of thinking about it, you know, if you think about Kant saying that everything's like secondary qualities, that all qualities are secondary qualities. Imagine, like, people use this expression, someone sees the world through rose-colored glasses. Imagine, like, from birth, like, they strap, like, these red glasses on you that cause you to see the world, you know, red. You would see the world, everything is red, and you wouldn't know what another color looked like. I suppose, then what would happen if there's a green object and red that combine, I don't know what, how that would work. But you would at least, you would experience everything through with a red shade on it. And even though there might be individual objects which might be brighter red or darker red, or maybe like a really brilliant hue, it might merge with the red and you might get like red and blue, you might see something like in purple or something like that. But it'll all be some shade of red, and you would never know what it would be to see white, for example. And you would never be able to know, as long as those glasses are strapped to your head. Well, if you think about those rose-colored glasses, you know, glued to your eyes, think about all the categories of human thought and all and your five senses as being something you're sort of stuck with when you're born. And there's no way to jump out of your skull and jump out of your brain and to perceive the world unaided by the five senses, you know, unless you have like an out-of-body experience or something. But even then, people have these out-of-body experiences. What do they see? Shapes and colors, and they hear sound, they hear people talking. So even if they're out-of-body experiences, people seem to have the same kind of experiences. Comments, questions? Yeah.
So, I mean, with this in mind, what we all as a collective are perceiving are these preconditioned ideas from history or from unseen force or just from just the forced conditioning of collective awareness?
I think Kant would say that a lot of it's biology, and it's the way the human brain works. And then part of it is psychology, but psychology essentially comes from biology. Kant believes we had souls too, so I'm not sure what. But I mean, he thinks that the soul sort of has to work through the brain like Descartes does. But I think he would say culture and history have little to do with how you perceive things. I mean, you might be wrong about it to some extent, but I think maybe overall, probably right.
So, with that, I mean, I'm just going to work off something you said. If Kant believes that the human being has a soul, whatever that is, right? Mm-hmm. But he doesn't choose to believe that we, as an experience of life, can't see outside of our senses. How does he explain the soul, which is separate from the physical being, from the physical manifestation of life?
I'm trying to remember, like, I mean, Kant has some particular arguments about, he gives an argument for God's existence based on morality. And so maybe it's a roundabout way. I'm not sure if he ever talks about, you know, proof of the soul, but I know that Kant, yeah.
Well, Descartes says a priori, the proof that there is a God.
Yeah. No, I think Kant thinks that it's not a priori, but he thinks that, well, example. I'm trying to think of whether his moral argument could be called a priori. He thinks that we have ethical intuitions about right and wrong. So I guess, and he thinks ethics is a priori. So I guess he says that we have an intuition of right and wrong, that there could never be such a thing as right and wrong without a moral lawgiver. There would be no absolute ethics without a God. And so in that way, you know, he proves there's a God. And if you know that there's a God who's a disembodied mind, then you know that your mind, you know, can survive the death of the body too, or could. So I don't know a lot about Kant's religious views. I just know that he did believe in souls and he believed in God. But I think he, in his epistemology, he's sticking with you know, human knowledge and human experience. So, and he's trying to explain what lays the groundwork for science. That's what a lot of these guys are working on, going back to Descartes. What's the foundation of human knowledge? Where does it start? Now, Kant, you know, was a Christian too, and he believed stuff in the Bible, but he said you can't do science that way. You can't say, you can't just quote the Bible and quote some old philosopher. You have to prove it. And he thought that science and reason sort of went along together and that you wouldn't get contradictions between the two. So he wasn't really worried about that in the same way that Berkeley was. Yeah.
Weren't a lot of these gentlemen deists, is that how you say?
Kant was a pietist. So he was. So that's actually, I mean, the pietism is was a movement that really emphasized like a personal relationship with God. So actually, probably, the, I mean, in some ways, the opposite of a deist. deism is more like a, I guess, around the time of Kant. I'm trying to think. I mean, deism was around at the time of Kant.
Was it?
That was sort of in its heyday then, actually. Maybe I'm just trying to think the dates. Yeah, I guess around there. So, you know, some of the founding fathers, like Thomas Paine, was kind of a deist. But yeah, Kant. I mean, Kant had Kant, and actually, I'm trying to think of all these guys. So Locke, Berkeley, and Hume. Yeah, they're all. Hume's kind of a skeptic. Locke and Berkeley, both Christians. Descartes, Catholic. Locke, I think, is the Church of England. And Locke's kind of like a liberal Christian, though. He has a lot of bad things to say about religious people. He calls them the enthusiasts, like sort of the holy roller types, and people that get carried away, and the Puritans. He didn't like those guys at all. So anyway, all these guys are religious in one stripe or another, except for Hume. Hume's probably probably an atheist, but doesn't like come right out and say it, I think, because he doesn't want to get in trouble. although, I mean, there were atheists in the writing at Hume's time. Hume wrote this thing called the Dialogues on Natural Religion, where he talks about the traditional definition of God and all the proofs of God in dialogue form. And it's actually pretty readable. And he goes through and basically says all the arguments for God's existence are non-starters. But he's got this character in there named Demia, who has a kind of an Eastern concept of God, who, and Hume might have had some sympathies for that kind of more mystical version of God. Hard to say. Anyway, yeah.
When did Kant write his epistemology?
So let's see, the dates, I think that, I mean, most of the stuff is being written in the 18th century. I'm trying to see if his major works.
Or science and stuff, you get away from God and not get in trouble.
Well, I mean, later on, people aren't so much. I mean, Hume's time, it's sort of, it goes from like being worried about, like, so in Descartes' time, you worried about being like, you know, thrown on the rack. Mm-hmm. By the time you get to Hume, it's just sort of like a social faux pas. You don't get invited to parties, you know, if you're like an atheist. You know, people don't like you. But it's not like you have to worry about being dragged out of your house in the middle of the night by the Inquisition at that time. And Hume was a party animal. He clamored for fame and just like was a very social person. So that might have been why he was like that. He's kind of a character. He wrote this, his first book, and he said it fell stillborn from the press, so it was sort of like an abortion of a book. And basically he published it and it was expecting to be famous, and nobody bought it, and it was like a total flop, and he was crushed. And so then he went to work as a historian, and he wrote these histories that are still being used in English schools today, actually. Or British schools. And then he wrote this other book, which is a revision of his first book, and finally got all the fame and fortune. By that time, he was already famous, but then he got to be famous as a philosopher and was really happy. But he was like a jovial guy that liked to go around and...
And who is that?
Go to all the parties. Hume. David Hume. And he was pals with Adam Smith, you know, the father of modern economics, and they had similar political views too. So they believed in individual liberty and personal responsibility and all that good stuff. So that's one of the reasons I like him. And so he has he didn't write a lot of like political philosophy, but he was a big supporter of Adam Smith when he was first getting started. Let me just get
I think I've got the. Don't I have the date and the text of when Hume, or when Kant wrote his Metaphysics of the Critique of Pure Reason is the big one that Kant wrote.
Isn't he like in his 20s or something like that when he first wrote something?
I think he wrote some stuff when he was young. I think the Critique, which was sort of considered to be his most important work in epistemology, was Critique of Pure Reason. I don't have the date here. I get the exact date here. I guess if there's anything else about Kant, we did new and new phenomena, we did analytic, synthetic, talked about the category a little bit. I think that's pretty much it. Maybe look at the Kant on the mind. That's the other thing we need to talk about briefly. So, yeah, David Hume says, as an empiricist, you can't know you have a mind. Kant says that's crazy. But it follows from empiricism. So the problem in Kant's view is just really with empiricism. And he says, if you think about the way you learn and the way you like, suppose you have a... You notice like some really weird wavy distortion lines on a hot summer day down the road. And you're like, that's weird. It looks like there's water in the road. And then you walk up to there and you look at the road and it's completely dry. And you're thinking, well, that's weird. And you look up ahead and the same amount of distance, you see that same water. You look there and you're like, that's where you get there, and it's the same thing. And so eventually your mind sort of puts this all together and says, oh, this must be an illusion. It's a hallucination. And then maybe, do some scientific investigation, figure out why that happens. But your mind is able to put your past experiences, your present perception together to form a theory about, something being an illusion. Or you take like the stick and water thing, which is usually used as like if you take a stick and you stick it into water, it'll look bent. And then you pull it out and it's straight. Well, you can like reach your hand into the water and feel it up and down using your senses, your touch sensations, and see that it feels straight all the way down, even though it looks bent. And Kant says you'd sort of, nobody really thinks that the stick, when you stick in the water, bends. And so you're able to learn things through experience because your mind's able to see some things cause other things, some things are related to other things in certain ways. And you take new experiences and incorporate them into your view of the world. Well, if you're just a bundle of perceptions with just like individual sensations coming and going, you really couldn't learn anything, right? You'd have these loosely associated ideas, but you couldn't have anything we call knowledge. To have knowledge, you have to have a stable mind with a collection of data and all sorts of beliefs about the world, some of which are conscious, some of which might be unconscious, that helps you get along in the world. And to do that, you'd have to have a substantial mind that's able to integrate new experiences and learn from them. And a bundle of perceptions really couldn't do that. So that's not really a refutation, but I think Kant again would say, what is our experience? Our experience is that we learn, we approach the world, we have experiences, we learn from them, and we're able to integrate those new experiences into our view of the world, and it helps us predict the future and what's going to happen, and helps us get along in the world. What would have to be the case for us to have that kind of experience? He said, well, we'd have to have a mind that's able to perform those functions and is able to gather knowledge, and a bundle of perceptions would not do that. And so therefore we have to have a substantial enduring mind in order to explain our experience. Okay.
I think maybe I'll start out the review. Maybe I'll just start out with Kant, since he's fresh in your mind, and go back to Barclay again. Or maybe, I don't know.
I'm tempted to do that.
Maybe I will do that. Did Kant live from 1724 to 1804? I had the ripe old age of 79.
What was this again?
1724 to 1804. And I'm looking for his critique. The Critique of Pure Reason was published in 1781. So that's... So he would have been 60-something. And that was like his big thing. And he wrote his ethics came later in the late 1780s and 1790s.
Was he always a philosopher?
Yeah, he's, you know, went to school, university, and then decided he liked school, and then decided to stick around as a professor. He was sort of it's funny, if you read his ethics, it sort of fits in with his ethics as this sort of duty-based, kind of rigid view. And what people would joke about, that they could set their watch by the time that Kant would take his walks. He'd like go walking like exactly the same time every day. He spent most of his time alone in his study writing. So the exact opposite of Hume, I think, who's sort of the life of the party. Kant's sort of more of a loner, kind of a dour German guy. Okay, so just look at these questions for review on Kant. So explain the difference between analytic and synthetic truths and give an example of each. Okay, let's see. So, somebody tell me, what's the difference between an analytic and a synthetic truth?
Analytic statement is something, the statement that the words are in the definition, like the triangle has three sides.
Okay, that's the definition. A triangle has three sides, and what kind of truth is that? Analytic or synthetic?
Analytic,
right, because it's a definition of something. So analytic, and the definition is it where the subjects contain the predicate, or the predicates contain the subject? Predicates contain in the subject. So make sure that you don't get that reversed on the exam, because it'll have a faux answer there that says the subjects contain the predicate, which is wrong. So if you have the subject, a triangle, and has three sides as a predicate. And the idea is that the has three sides is contained in the concept of a triangle, the subject.
On the synthetic part, would you say that would be like the formula to find the area of a triangle, half times explicit length times base? Is that the synthetic side of that?
Formula for calculate the area of a triangle, or
yeah, like just the formula, would that be a synthetic truth?
Yeah, because it's mathematics,
right?
So this is like what, and one way of thinking about it, you're just saying what a triangle is. Analytic statements say what a thing is. They describe the essences or natures of things, and you're just really unpacking the subject. Now, it gets kind of iffy when you, like, there's some things that it's hard to sort of tell, like the thing you mentioned, the interior angles equal 180 degrees. Is that analytic or is that synthetic? Is it part of the definition of the triangle that the interior angles are equal to 180 degrees, or is it just a fact about triangles? Kant says mathematics is synthetic, so I think unless it's a definition of something, then it's still synthetic. That's kind of an iffy one. I suppose, are there any triangles without interior angles that equal 180 degrees? I mean, so I won't give you any iffy ones on the test. Another, what would be an example of a synthetic statement using triangles?
about Farrell is writing a screenplay called Triangle, the psychological thriller.
Alternative title: Three Ways to Die.
So, but that's a synthetic fact, right? Because it's not about the definition. I don't have like a definition of me. Like, I suppose I could say, you know, I'm a human being. So if I had put Bardell as a human, you know, assuming, you know, professors are human, or this isn't like that. What's that movie? The Faculty, or the high school teachers all turn out to be aliens. So assuming I am human, you know, actually it would still be analytic, right? It'd just be analytic, and it would be false. So a triangle has four sides. It's still an analytic truth. It's just analytically false. Bardell's human. That's it's about me. It's about my definition. What defines me? I'm a human being. Bardell's writing a screenplay. That's not doesn't define like what I am. It's just a fact about me. So
now, if you said the triangle is blue, that would be synthetic, correct?
Right. Because it's about a particular triangle. It's not about all triangles. And it doesn't define what a triangle is. You're just talking. It just gives a fact about a particular triangle. So, this would be analytic.
So, I mean, you could say like analytic is describing what something is, but like, what would that synthetic is describing
something about it?
Something like, I'm just not sure how to word that. Describing what you
think. Analytic is the definition. Yeah.
Facts about a thing.
It's almost like synthetic has to be facts about a thing from sense experience.
What a thing is. What, you know, definition.
It's kind of like the redundancies.
Yeah, I mean, they're trivial truths. Like, if you know what a triangle is, you know the statement, a triangle is a three-sided figure, is true. If you know what a bachelor is, you know the statement, a bachelor is an unmarried male, is true. But if you know what a bachelor is, and someone says John is a bachelor, do you know whether that's true or not? Just from the concept of bachelor, right? You have to use, and so that's, and I'm getting back into the a priori, a posteriori thing. But to John is a bachelor is not about the definition of John. I mean, John, insofar as like a person has a definition, you know, John is a, John is a human being. That's just like, that's what defines John. And I suppose, like, if you think about definitions of people, it's just basically their being a person, being a human being. That would be definitional. The fact that John's married isn't part of his essence, right? Because he could get divorced and still be John. When you get divorced, you don't turn into something different. So when you're talking about the essence, you know, essences don't change. If you're a human being, you can't go from being a human being to being something else and not become something and not be something completely different. That sounds kind of, maybe that's not as clear as it could be. It's like when I was talking about, like, you wouldn't say that I could turn into a chair and still be me. You would say that somebody killed Bardell and turned him into a chair. But it's not. You wouldn't say, you know, Professor Bardell is in my living room right now and then like sit in the chair that was made for my bones or something. Right? You would say, oh, I killed Bardell. Bardell no longer exists. I made a chair of his bones. Because you can't. So you can't. If a thing has an essence that defines what it is. You can't change that quality and have it still be the same thing. So this is why, like, suppose I find out that there's a project in development that has my exact same idea with Paramount, and I burn my screenplay and fall into deep despair, as I did with the screenplay I was writing about the 300 Spartans that were going to hold the pass of Thermopylae against the invading Persian army, and the Merlin script, and all those other ones. So if the, you know, I could stop writing the script, I would still be me. I would still be the same person. And so my essence is being a human being. The fact that I'm writing a screenplay is just a fact about me that happens to be true. It's not a necessary truth about who I am, and it's not about my identity. It's not about what I am. Okay, so that's the analytics. So this is just a fact about.
Make sure you don't confuse this. This is where it is writing a screenplay.
There's that new Bermuda Triangle movie out there. What's it? Is it called Triangle? What do they call that? I heard there's a new movie about the Bermuda Triangle. Do they get called a triangle?
I haven't heard of that.
Really?
Are you talking about that alien one?
No, it's like a Bermuda Triangle thing.
I know what you're talking about. What's the title though?
The bastards are going to call that triangle. Oh, man. Anyway, what a triangle. So you get the idea. So, a cup is a container of liquid for the purpose of.
Butterfingers.
This drinking. So that's the definition of a cup. It's about all cups. It's about what a cup is. But if I say, this cup is purple, then that's just a fact about this particular cup. Or if, even if I say, I can make a statement about all cups. Cups are useful or something like that.
Cups have bottoms.
Drums for glasses to cups or something like that. Or bottles, I guess. But that's like a fact about, that's a fact about drunks. It's not something that's like, that doesn't define what being a drunk is. A drunk is someone that just drinks too much alcohol and can't stop. Or whatever just describing a drunk is. A drunk is an alcoholic who doesn't have to go to all those damn meetings. Anyway, so you get the idea. Analytics, synthetic. And then how does this work with a priori and a posteriori? I says, according to Kant, would Kant agree that all analytic statements are a priori?
Yes.
Yeah. Would he agree that all synthetic statements are all a posteriori?
No.
Right? So he says there's some a priori statements that are there's some things that are known through reason which aren't analytic. There's some a priori things which aren't analytic, the synthetic a priori, which is this stuff up here. And this is the most important category of knowledge. Because this is, this is Kant's I think, therefore I am. This is the starting place for knowledge, is that we know these certain things about the world, would have to be true about the world in order for us to have the experiences that we do have. Therefore, we must know these things as a rational intuition. Okay. So this human Kant thing we talked about today, and just like that chart that we were looking at last time and talking about today, should answer that. Are there any questions about this question 2 on page 156? How do human Kant compare the question of the relationship between a priori and a posteriori, analytic and synthetic? So it's just, look at the chart on page 151. Answer that. And remember that Kant says mathematics is also synthetic.
Put that up there.
That why does Kant say every event has a cause or a presupposition of science? If you have to assume cause and effect in order to do science. Like, remember my example with the wobbling planet, you know. If you're going to do science, you can't say, well, maybe it's just wobbling for no reason. You assume that there's a cause. And science is about trying to figure out what those causes are. You can't be a skeptic about cause and effect and be a scientist. Explain how Kant forms a synthesis between rationalism and empiricism. What about Kant's theory is rationalist? What about is it empiricist? Well, again, what's rational is there are some things you know through pure reason. Like Descartes' I think before I am, it's the synthetic a priori, which is the rationalist part, the a priori part of Kant's philosophy. And then the rest follows a general empirical method. So what's empiricist about it, once you have this foundation, these presuppositions of science, then when you're doing the actual science, you're going out there and you're investigating and you're using scientific instruments to augment the senses and so on. Compare Hume and Kant on the questions of causation of the self. The distinction is, you know, Hume is a skeptic about cause and effect, doesn't believe in it because you can't detect it with the senses. Kant says that's crazy, and there has to be cause and effect in order to explain the way we experience the world. And to say he's the same thing about the self, that both cause and effect and the self are things we know exist. We can't know through the senses, so we have to know it through reason. This last question on 158, I really want. How do both Berkeley and Hume's views cast doubt on the supposed relationship between empiricism and modern science? How does Kant's epistemology offer a better fit with modern science than empiricism? Okay, so actually, there was a question on the exam about this. And basically, it's that Kant's view seems to fit the best with modern science. Because if you're an empiricist, you can't believe in cause and effect. You can't believe in that you have a mind. You can't believe there's a material world. You can't prove any of those things with the senses. You have to have some rational intuition that you throw in the mix there, some foundation before you start using your senses. If you restrict yourself to what you can detect with the five senses, you end up with a view like Berkeley or Hume's. And with these counterintuitive beliefs that by the time you get to Hume, it's, you know, nothing exists except for ideas. Or Hume uses the word perceptions. And by perceptions, he just means, you know, discrete states of consciousness, little feelings of heat and cold and memories of your childhood home and just shapes and colors floating around there in the ether. Some of them are bundled together in mysterious ways and we don't know why. And that's all you can say. Well, most scientists are materialists. At least, you know, for methodology, for their methodology. If you're a scientist, you're not looking and investigating, you know, the relations of ideas. You're looking out there at the material world and trying to figure out what causes what. That doesn't fit very well with Hume's view. But Hume is the most consistent empiricist. He applies it across the board, and it ends up with a very, you know, strange, counterintuitive conclusions which don't fit in with modern science at all. Okay. Let's go back to Berkeley. There will be a question on the pronunciation of Berkeley's name on the exam. And this is a class, I'll have to give you guys credit. I only heard a few Berkeleys early on, and then it was Berkeley all the way down. So I congratulate you. Sometimes I'll get people that will just say, keep on saying Berkeley till the last day of class. They'll say Berkeley till the last day of class. So it's Berkeley. And you just remember, like, bark like a dog, you know. I used to say Berkeley, Berkeley to students because they just keep on doing it. So, let's see.
What reason did Berkeley give for rejecting Locke's representationalism? This is on page 128. In particular, how does he attack the concept of matter? So Berkeley gives an awful lot of arguments against the concept of matter. His first argument is to ask, Philonous representing Berkeley, and actually this will be on the exam too. So Philonous represents the views of Berkeley, and Hylas represents the views of Locke. And so Philonous says to Hylas, material substratum, by which of your senses came you to be acquainted with that being? And then Hylas is like, well, none of them, I guess. Well, it's not something you can actually see. But see, this is the way it goes, and he goes this long explanation. You don't see it directly, but you see it indirectly, and you suppose that your senses give you all these qualities, and the qualities got to come from somewhere, and so that you create this concept of a something that's causing you to have these sensations, and that's what substance is. And he doesn't answer the question. The question is like, hey, okay, Hylas, you say you're an empiricist, you believe in senses like I do, you think that's the way to knowledge, so how does this idea of substance fit in with the empiricism? Try to prove it with reference to senses, and Hylas ends up not being able to do it. And so the argument is that if you're going to be an empiricist, you can't believe in something which can't be detected through the five senses, which can't be directly detected. So this whole stuff about what's immediately known through the senses and immediately known, or what's known, through the senses and what can be known directly. And he says you don't have any direct experience of the senses, of matter through the senses. So therefore, there's no reason to suppose it exists. And then he shows that so there's no evidence from the senses that matter exists. And then he also shows it leads to all sorts of contradictions. So Hylas says substance is that which supports qualities. Well, if substance is supporting qualities, it's got to be spread out underneath it. Well, if it's spread out underneath it, there has to be another substance underneath it to support it, because if it's spread out, it has a quality of extension. Extension is a quality, you need something to support it, because substance is that which supports qualities. So there's got to be another substance under that, another substance under that, and you just like go on forever. You get an infinite regress. That shows there's a problem with the concept of substance, because a concept that makes sense isn't going to give you an infinite regress. Let's see. He talks about insensible versus sensible. So he says, have you ever proved that there's such that matter is supposed to be insensible? But he says, what when you look at the table, what do you see? And he's like, well, I see the table. So is it the table? So you sense the table before you, is that the table before you, that's the table you sense, right? Yeah. Okay. How do you know there's a table there? We feel it, touch it, Maybe you lick it, right? You taste it. you can use your senses to figure out there's a table there. The table is the table you experience. That's the real table. Hylas says, yeah, I agree. But then they go on, and he's like, well, but that's not really the real table. There's like a real table which causes you to have those sensations. And so, commonsensically, Berkeley says, well, the world you experience is a world you see, touch, taste, smell, and hear. And that's why Berkeley says, I'm the philosopher of common sense. I say the real table is the table you experience, it's the table you can touch, it's the table you can smell, it's the table you can run your hand along and knock on and it makes a sound. Locke is left to say, well, you can never see the real table. And then they talk about sound, and he says, do you ever hear it? And Berkeley says, my view is that you hear sounds. What's your view? And Locke says, well, sounds, it's like a disturbance in the medium of air. And so it's like a vibration. And so what's it, a vibration? And Berkeley says, well, isn't a vibration something you feel? And he's like, okay, yeah, I guess that's true. So
you can never hear a sound, you can only feel it. That doesn't sound right. And so he tries to poke holes in the concept of matter by showing at least all these crazy contradictions, like you can never hear a sound, you can only feel it, and you can never see a real table, and so on. And then there's this, you know, the other argument that it's, you know, it's just gives fodder to atheists that it lets people believe there's a world apart from God. And he doesn't, I mean, Berkeley doesn't press that really hard. He just sort of mentions it in passing. So you shouldn't characterize Berkeley as just sort of like being some religious nut who's trying to get people to believe in God. He's giving a serious philosophical argument, and he seems to be winning a lot of the arguments here in his dialogue.
Gives Locke enough credit?
What's that?
Would you say he gives Locke a pretty good voice?
Yeah, I mean, I think he gives an accurate portrayal of Locke's argument. Mm-hmm. And the reason Locke comes on the short of the stick is because, I mean, for one, because Berkeley's writing this. Yeah. But for another, because Berkeley has some good arguments about Locke, against Locke. And I think that, again, if you're going to be an empiricist, if you're not going to go over to a more Kantian view, you know, Locke is susceptible to all these attacks on the concept of matter as an empiricist. This poem here, "To Be Is to Be Perceived," or this poem illustrates "To Be Is to Be Perceived" in that it says, well, what happens? You know, Berkeley's view is to say something exists means that to say that some mind is having a certain experience. So X exists means there's an idea of X in somebody's mind. So this poem here addresses the question, what happens to the tree when nobody's looking at it? And the answer is, well, God's looking at the tree, and God sees all. So even when everybody goes home for the day, we don't have a tree in our quad. But you imagine there was a tree in the quad, right? And when everybody goes home and, you know, they turn off the overhead lights and you know, public safety is back in their office reading, nobody's looking at the tree. So does the tree just pop out of existence? And Berkeley says, no, God always sees the tree. And so that explains the stability of the world, that God sees things even when we're not looking at them. So even when no one is having an idea of the tree, and no human person is having an idea of the tree, God's having an idea of the tree. So we avoid, this is the way he's able to avoid the counterintuitive consequence that, oh, when everybody leaves the room, everything pops out of existence. He says, no, it doesn't. God always sees what's going on in this room, even when nobody's here. Berkeley claims that he in no way denies the existence of real things, but merely gives the concept of a real thing its proper definition. And this is a key thing to remember, that Berkeley couches himself as a philosopher of common sense. I believe in common sense, and I believe in the senses. I believe the real world is the world you experience. And so, but what's a real thing? What's a real cherry? A real cherry is a red, round, sweet thing that's delicious to eat. Is it object made of material substance? And Berkeley says that's ridiculous. That's not what you mean when you're talking about a cherry. It's the red, round, sweet thing with the hard pit in the middle. Those are all sensory properties. So according to Berkeley, objects are just collections of qualities or collections of ideas.
So real things are collections of ideas?
Right, real things are collections of ideas. And that answers the second thing. I already answered the second question, which is just that Berkeley says he's a philosopher of common sense because he says the real world is a world that you see, touch, taste, and smell, and hear. Now, what could be more common sense than that? You know, the real world is the tangible world. What does tangible mean? Well, it means you can lay your hands on it and touch it and feel it and experience it. What role does God play in Berkeley's system? Well, God's the author of ideas. So some ideas come from you, and those are your imagination and your memory. But a lot of your ideas come from God. And what most people would call perception of a material world, Berkeley says those are just ideas given you by God from moment to moment. And so it's sort of like the arch deceiver, except for God not fooling you. God's just sending you experiences. Yeah.
So it's just God is sending you these ideas?
Yeah. Okay. He's just producing the ideas in your mind. Again, like the arch-deceiver, but God's not deceiving anyone. Because God never told you there was a world separate from your ideas. You're reading that Locke guy again. He's talking about this material substratum. Where did you hear about that apart from like some skeptical philosopher trying to get you to not believe in God anymore? Does Berkeley accept Locke's distinction between primary and secondary qualities? Why or why not? Ooh, this is one we haven't talked about before. Let's see if you guys can reason this out. Does Berkeley accept Locke's distinction between primary and secondary qualities? What would you think? What's the primary quality?
Shape,
right? Shape, size, temperature, density. So these are the real properties of objects, the real qualities of objects. Secondary qualities are qualities which are caused by the primary qualities, which in part depend on how we experience the world, how we sense the world. Like color is a secondary quality. Well, if there's no material world, is there any distinction between the color of an object and the shape of an object? So Berkeley completely rejects the concept of primary secondary qualities. Because there is no real material substance and sort of fakey quality caused by real material substance and its properties. Right? So Locke would say the surface structure of the things causing the light to go into your eyes at a certain angle, and that's going to cause you to have red sensations, but the object's not really red. Well, if they're all ideas coming in your mind by God, the idea of color and the idea of shape are going to be just both ideas. So one's not any more real than the other. What would be the difference between perception and imagination in Berkeley's thinking? Perception, those are the ideas that God gives you. Imaginations, those are the ones you cook up yourself. That is more real than the other. It's not like there's a real world that you're perceiving, but imagination is fake because it's all ideas. So perceptions are just the ideas God gives you, and imagination are the ones you give yourself. In the second dialogue, what argument does Berkeley give for God's existence? And this is just this idea that when you try to do something and you can't do it, that's your intuition of God. That's your awareness of God. You have a notion of God as the one that thwarts your intentions. Most people would say it's a material world that keeps me from doing 100 push-ups. But he says that's God can send you the idea of fatigue when you try to do number 99. Hume. I gotta do Hume in a couple of minutes here. So Hume is like Berkeley without God. Hume breaks perceptions into two kinds, impressions and ideas. So the general term for Hume, perceptions. Two kinds of perceptions. There's impressions, which are the vivid, lively ones that force themselves on you. Like when you see a tree or walk into a tree, you feel the sensation of hardness, you feel the rough bark on your forehead, right? You feel the impact. Right, and it forces itself on you, whether you want you have those sensations, whether you want them or not. Then later on, you're thinking, "What an idiot! I walked right into that tree while I was talking to my friend about some philosophical topic," and you remember the rough bark, but it's kind of hazy. You don't remember like the texture. You don't remember exactly how big the tree was. It's just kind of a copy of the impression. And that's impressions come from impressions are the vivid, lively ones, and ideas are faint copies of impressions. Where do the impressions come from? Nobody knows.
You say impressions
are
what?
Impressions are faint copies of. Sorry, no. Ideas are faint copies of impressions. Impressions are vivid, lively perceptions which force themselves on you. Ideas are something you can create yourself. They're active, not passive. They're not forced on you. You can create whatever ideas you want. And they're faint copies of the impressions you've had. And nobody knows where the impressions come from.
Okay.
Since Hume doesn't believe in the material world, doesn't believe in God, he says it's a big question mark. Nobody knows. Hume doesn't believe in cause and effect, and he gives the argument, various arguments against it. The main one is that you can't verify the necessary connection between cause and effect through your senses. So you can prove priority in time with your senses. You can show the objects have to touch, but you can't observe the necessary connection between cause and effect. Therefore, Hume says, it's just a psychological habit that you expect something to happen after seeing it happen over and over again the same way. You see A and B and A and B, you see A and then you expect B. But it's not rational, it's not logical, and it's not provable. And so Hume rejects cause and effect because you can't verify the necessary connection between cause and effect. And Hume says you don't have a mind because a mind to be a thing would have to be a substance. But Hume rejects the concept of substance. He rejects material substance and he rejects spiritual substance. You know, Berkeley still believes in spiritual substance. Berkeley believes in intentions as a kind of mental cause and effect. Hume rejects all of it, and he just has ideas and the association of ideas. And so you are just a bundle of perceptions. There's no substance in which those perceptions exist. There's just the perceptions themselves. And it's just because if you think about yourself, all you hit on is like, I'm tired, I'm hungry, I want to go home, I wish this class was over. And there's no me there. All you do, there's just the sensation of heat or cold or fatigue. There's no me there in the sensation. All you observe is the perceptions. There's just this weird thing that I can't experience what you're experiencing and you can't experience what I'm experiencing. So that's the bundling, is just the bundling of perceptions into different people. But those people aren't substances or things. It's just some mysterious fact about perceptions that they tend to be grouped in certain ways. And I think that covers Hume. Feel free to send me a little message if you have any questions. No office hours tomorrow or Friday, but I'll be looking at my Moodle messages. So I'm going to be going away for a weekend trip. Feel free to message me on Moodle, and I'll see you guys on Monday. No, Wednesday. Monday's a holiday. The exam will be open through Thursday of next week. Through Thursday of next week.